Okay, so we're talking about what makes bonds. So we're focusing, rather than on the molecular orbitals that cover the whole thing and are very complicated in their shape, just locally on how two atomic orbitals can overlap and make bonds. And last time we talked about carbon atoms and how by hybridizing they can get much better overlap and therefore stronger bonds. But there's this interesting question that if overlap is what stabilizes electrons, then why don't you just increase overlap to the limit of one? That is, why don't you just let the whole thing come together and the electrons would get more and more stable, one would think, because of the increased overlap. So why don't these plum puddings just collapse? Why doesn't H2 become a helium atom? In fact, electrons do become more stable. The electrons in helium are 55% more stable than the electrons in a hydrogen molecule, the two electrons. That's 650 kilocalories per mole, as much as six or seven bonds. So it really would get, the electrons would get a lot more stable if H2 collapsed to HE. What would get worse? If the nuclei came together and the electrons got more and more stable. If the electrons win by 650 kilocalories per mole, why doesn't that happen? Daisuke? Pardon me? Yeah, the nuclei repel one another, right? The proton-proton repulsion increases according to 1 over R. That's much more dramatic than the small increase in overlap. And of course, when the R became zero, if the nuclei really got right together, it would be infinite. Right, and already, if it's moved from the normal bonding distance, which is about 1 angstrom, to 0.3 angstroms, the two nuclei, their repulsion already wipes out all of the 650 kilocalories you'd get by their coming all the way together. So there's no way you're going to win with that. Unless you use neutron glue, right? Helium has neutrons in it too. And if you're into nuclear energy, which I'm not, nuclear physics, then those nuclei, those neutrons help hold the protons together. But it's hard to get there because of the Coulombic repulsion. But if you do it, if D2 becomes HE, on the sun, that's what happens. But the electrons are completely irrelevant. Who cares about 650 kilocalories per mole if you're making 200 million kilocalories per mole by the nuclei? But that's another story. That's and not one I can tell you because I don't know anything about that. But anyhow, what keeps the molecule from collapsing and make the electrons more and more stable as you increase overlap is the nuclear repulsion. Okay, so then this is the Morse law bonding potential that we saw before. But now we understand why it has the form it does. Out at the right, as the things start to come together, the electron pair becomes more stable because overlap is increasing and increasing. But if you get too close, then that 1 over R repulsive energy between the nuclei becomes dominant and it shoots way up to infinity as it gets, to infinity if R became zero. Okay, so that's it. And all of this came just from Coulomb's law. Right, that's the potential energy of the individual particles. And Schrödinger's kinetic energy for the electron, which is what made them spread out and have this property. Okay. Now, and then when you have this curve, you have to deal with the electrons, which move very rapidly and are way spread out by Schrödinger's equation. You have to deal with them as a cloud, right? But once you've done that, then you know, for a given distance between the nuclei, what the energy of the electrons is and what the energy of the nuclei is. Right? So you know the total energy is a function of distance between the nuclei just by doing a lot of these calculations. So then you have this form. And once you know that this is the form of kinetic energy, or of potential energy, pardon me, actually what it is potential energy plus the kinetic energy of the electrons. Right? So, but anyhow, that's the effective energy as a function of the distance between the nuclei. So now you can treat the nuclear distribution quantum mechanically, because you know this is the potential. It's the one you plugged into Erwin meets Goldilocks. So you can see what wave functions a proton would have if it were bound by a bond like this, right? And in fact, you already did that and showed what energy levels were allowed for nuclei, for atoms as they in a molecule, vibration and so on. So that's where this curve comes from, Coulomb's law and the kinetic energy of the electrons. Okay? So finally, we understand the atom-atom force law, right? And you remember that that's what Newton wanted us to do. There are agents in nature able to make the particles of bodies stick together by very strong attractions, and it is the business of experimental philosophy to find them out, and we found it out, right? That's what makes things stick together. Coulombic energy, potential energy, and the kinetic energy of the electrons. So we've done it. Now, we could vote again. Right? We voted before we started this exercise several weeks ago as to what it is that holds atoms together. And so I'll give you a chance to redeem yourselves here. Okay, so how many think it's gravity? Zero this time. Okay, last year it was zero before and zero after. Okay, how about electrical forces? Okay, is there anybody that doesn't think it's electrical forces? Are you going to vote, Joyce? Which way are you going to vote? Abstain? Yes or no? Yes, okay. So that's unanimous. Okay, it was unanimous last year, too. There were fewer voters by this time. Okay, magnetic forces. Magnetic forces. Any votes? Oh, same as last year. Kinetic energy. Anybody doesn't think that? Why do you think not? Chris? Hunch. Last year it was unanimous. Nobody went on a hunch last year. Quantum forces. There is no such thing as quantum forces. Shared electron pairs. Yeah, that's certainly involved, I'd say. But we got maybe 8 or 10 votes here, I would say. It was unanimous last year. I need to emphasize that more. Quarks. Nope. The strong force. What holds nuclei together? One? We got one? Okay, one. The weak force. Why do you say so, Christina? So it must work? So does it hold atoms together? What? Yeah. Oh, I see. So what you mean is it holds the nucleus together. Yeah. Okay, that's not... Oh. What? Oh, that's why you went for... what did you go for? Oh, for quarks? No, what? Strong force. Yeah, okay, good. I see. So that's a sophisticated answer. But if we were dealing with nuclei, it depends on the definition of atoms. Okay, good. So you're with me. Okay. Last year that was zero. Strange attractors? Anybody ever heard of strange attractors? That's just as well. Okay. There were, this year, none on that. Exchange of photons. Any votes for exchange of photons? One?
Virtual photons. Oh, that's not fair.
I'll include virtual photons. That probably goes in the next one. Okay, well, okay. So we had a couple votes for virtual photons. Okay, and in fact, that's, according to physicists, that's the basis of Coulomb's law, is the exchange of virtual photons. So in fact, it is related. But anyhow, I think we did much better than we did at the beginning, so we've made some progress. Okay, now, so we have this scheme that when the A and B are separate, They have whatever energies we show there. When they come together, you get new wave functions, molecular orbitals, A plus B, where reinforcement in the middle, A minus B. To the extent that they overlap and that A times B thing enters into their square, it has to be a little less or a little greater than 1 over the square root of 2. So we've seen that, and it results in splitting, and which is roughly proportional, this amount that the energies split apart is roughly proportional to the overlap. Okay? So more overlap, more stabilization for the first 2 electrons. Okay, now, what if the partner is lower in energy than A? Then how do we do this scheme if they're not the same? First, the question is, if one of the atomic orbitals is better than the other one, why should you use any of the less favorable one? You think the best, if one is better than the other, just use that one. Right? Why use any of the bad description, that which would give a density, would contribute to an electron density in an unfavorable region, one would think, if the molecule would be less favorable. So that seems a puzzle. And in fact, sometimes that's true. When we looked at the molecular orbitals of this somewhat fictitious molecule, it wouldn't be stable, it would fall apart actually. But we looked at its molecular orbitals nonetheless, and we looked at the 1s orbitals, and you remember what they looked like. The 1s orbital of fluorine, the 1s orbital of oxygen, the 1s orbital of first carbon and the second carbon. So they weren't mixed, at least not visibly mixed. Okay? So indeed, the lowest orbital is the lowest atomic orbital if they're sufficiently different. Okay? Now, so these remained pure and unmixed when we looked at molecular orbitals of that molecule. But the valence level atomic orbitals were very heavily mixed, like that one. Even though the 2s of fluorine is much lower than the 2s of any of the others, it still mixes with the others. You put some of the others in. Right? Now, why do they mix when you have the valence level orbitals, but they don't mix when you're looking at the core orbitals? Right? What advantage do you get from mixing? Yeah.
Does it have to do with shielding?
No, it doesn't have to do with shielding. Okay, so that's the 2s, then some hybrid orbital 2sp of oxygen contributes, even though it's higher in energy. So why do you use a little bit even of a 2s orbital on carbon? So why do you do that? Well, let's look at this. If you mix A with B and then square it to get the electron density, this is what you get. Part of a time, the small a squared, right? A and B are the fractions, right? Or more properly, A squared and B squared are the fractions of the electron density. So a certain fraction looks like A squared, a certain fraction looks like B. And then there's this overlap term. Now, suppose the energies of A is much higher, less favorable than that of the B orbital, right? And now you want to construct the best possible orbital. Now, if you were naive, you'd say B is better than A, use B. But in fact, the best mixture has a little bit of A in it, although not nearly as much A as B. But why have any of A? Okay? It's because it would be favorable, although it's bad to take electrons away from this atom, which has a big nuclear charge, say, and put them on this atom. That's bad. But about the electrons that are here on atom B, they would be happier if they were here, still on atom B, but close to A. Right? If you could shift the direction of the B electrons, keep them the same distance from the B nucleus, but have them on the side of A rather than away from A, then they would be better. But you don't want them to look like A, because that's not as good a place as B. Okay? So look what happens then if you make A, the little a, the amount of A squared, much smaller than B. Okay? So if A is really, that little a is really small, then the amount of A to A atom probability density is A squared up here, right? And if A is small, that little a is small, A squared is really, really small, right? So you don't make it look like A, or at least not very much, right? But A times B can still be significant even when a squared is small. So you don't put much of this in, but you put some of that overlap stuff in, which shifts the electron density to where A and B both have values, that is, on the side of B that's near A. So it does just what we'd like to do, change the shape of B, sort of, without very much making it look like A, which isn't such a great place to be. So, for example, if A, this coefficient here, were 0.03 and B were 0.98, right? Then when you square it, A squared is only a tenth of a percent. So it only a tenth of a percent looks like A squared. That's not good because it's not as low in energy as looking like B, right? B squared is 0.96 and 2AB is 0.06. So you can get a significant amount of this overlap stuff, which shifts the stuff to the side of B that's near A, without making it look very much like A. Does everybody see that? I'll say it again if you want to, but I bet you've seen it. Okay, and incidentally, these are proper numbers, because if the integral of AB is 0.06, which is typical, 0.6, and then if you work it through, it turns out that it sums up to 1, so that's a reasonable thing. Okay, so what it really does when you mix a little bit of the bad one in is shift the good one toward the side of that one. But overall, it's good to have mixed in that small amount of the less favorable orbital. So this is a case where you have poor energy match. So last time we looked at case one, where you change the overlap. Now we're going to look at what happens when you have a poor energy match and then change the overlap. So here are two atomic orbitals again. Actually, they're Hooke's law, obviously, but for purposes of convenience in running the program. Okay, but notice that they're not exactly the same energy. The one on the right is a little bit higher, so they don't match their energy exactly. So its potential energy is better here than it is there. Right? And now we're going to press the button and find the wave function, and it looks like that, the lowest energy wave function. Right? And it's almost all here, and just a teeny, teeny bit there. Okay? But the next orbital, so there's negligible mixing, right? The next orbital, which has a node in the middle here, looks like this. It's all on the right and only a teeny bit on the left, right? And now they're different in energy, but that difference in energy is just this difference in energy between here and here, right? This one is on the right, this one is on the left, the green one's on the left, and they're roughly independent of one another and have the corresponding energies. Right, so the splitting is due only to the original offset of those two wells. Okay? Now, suppose you increase overlap under this circumstance and make them try to bond. Okay? So you bring them a little closer, and there's a little bit more of this one in the green and a little bit more of this one in the red. But still, the energies don't change significantly. Okay? Because we haven't got enough overlap to do anything yet. Now we bring them closer still. And now the energies are beginning to split apart. The bonding one is going down in energy, the antibonding one is going up in energy, and there's more of the right well in the green and of the left well in the red. Right? And if we bring them still closer, now they look almost symmetric. Right? But they're not quite symmetric. You can see here that the green one is mostly on the left and the red one is mostly on the right. And now there's a significant difference here. But these two things are fighting one another. Overlap, to the extent overlap is important, you try to make them the same amplitude, right? To the extent that the energy difference is important, you try to make the lower energy one be on the left and the higher energy one be on the right, right? So these two things are in tension with one another. So increasing overlap fights the difference due to the well heights. Okay. So now, how does this work out if you make AC rather than AB, and C is a lower energy? What would make C a lower energy if they were atomic orbitals that we're talking about? How could you have an atomic orbital that's lower than another one? Well, what makes the energy lower? It's either potential energy or kinetic energy. So, what makes one atom have lower energy electrons than another one? I have a bigger nuclear charge. Okay? Or a different quantum number you could be talking about. Talk about 1 and 1s instead of 2s. Right? Okay, it'll look like this. It'll be that the favorable combination will look most more like C than like A. And the unfavorable antibonding combination with the negative sign will look more like A than like C. I think you'd agree that makes sense, right? And that's what we just saw with that double minimum. Okay. Now, there are larger energy shifts for the blue, for the original, when they were the same energy, you had this kind of energy shifts. When you have A with C, you only get this shift and this shift, right? So smaller energy shifts when the energies didn't match well to begin. The shifts are smaller, right? So that one looks mostly like C, both in shape, big on C, and in energy. Its energy is closer to C than A. And that one looks mostly like A in both respects. Okay? Now, if you want to know what their energies are, this is a sort of approximate formula. And it's not very complicated. And in fact, you've seen things like that before. What does it remind you of? You ever see a form like that before? A plus or minus the square root of B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 2AC squared over 2. That's what this is. And it comes from solving the same kind of thing. And it's only approximate because it doesn't take into account some things. But it's a good guess of what the energies are going to end up. But rather than plugging numbers in there, I think it's a lot easier to look at it visually. Okay? So, if the energies matched well, A and B, then a certain overlap will give a certain splitting. You have perfect energy match. And that splitting is the S. Okay? When you have perfect energy match. Okay, now, here you have the energy mismatch between A and C. And that distance there is this delta, the one that comes in here and also here. Okay? Now you can, once you know that those things correspond, you can interpret this formula pretty easily. So that dot there is the average of A and C. A is here, C is here. That's the average, right? And that's what this thing is. That's the average energy. If A is defined to be zero of energy, then the energy of the average of A and C is minus delta over 2. Okay, so that's the average energy. But now the new orbitals that you get when you mix A and C will be that plus or minus something here. Notice I made it minus plus because if you use the minus charge, it's antibonding. It goes up in energy. And if you use the plus sign, it's the bonding and goes down in energy. So this is minus plus and that's plus minus. Okay, so that's that. Now let's slide that over here where we're going to need it. Okay, and bend this one down. Remember, that's S. That's the amount of splitting you'd have if the energies were properly matched. Okay, and now what I'm going to do is make a rectangle there and draw its diagonal. Right, because that if this is S and this is delta, then the length of the orange thing is the square root of delta squared. I used the wrong sign. It should. Wait a second. I've got the wrong sign in here. It should be. I just added this to it this morning, and this should be plus here. I've got to go back and check that. I'm confident it's right. I'm not sure where I messed it up. Okay, so that's this new number. That's that part over up here. Okay, and now we put a pin in there, and rotate it so the orange is vertical. Right? And that now, the top and bottom of that give this, because it started here at this value, and then it's plus or minus that over 2. Okay? So the splitting is now larger than it was. right? The amount of separation of the two energies is bigger than it was before, because before you just had this part, and now you've added this to it on the diagonal there. So the orange is bigger than the original black was, or dark blue, actually, right? But then what this formula didn't take into account is this normalization thing. One's a little bigger and one's a little less, right? So you have to shift it up a little bit there, which I just did. So there are the new energies, A plus C and A minus C. Okay, so that's just a visual way of seeing what's going on. So for a given overlap, remember we used the same overlap in both cases for the S, right? The bonding shift, how much the red here, how much the energy is shifted on forming the bond, is reduced to the extent that the energy is mismatched, right? To the extent that C and A are different. This isn't as big as this was, or this isn't as big as that was, okay? So the energy shifts are smaller, but the splitting is greater. The overall splitting is greater, but the shift is smaller. Okay? And it must be, according to this, if you think through it, that this thing will end up lower than this one did. And the reason is C started lower. So it didn't go down as much as B did here, but it ended up lower. Okay. So, and now you can see some other things from this. That the splitting, how long this orange thing is less sensitive to the smaller of the two things. Here are these two things that contribute to it. The energy mismatch and the overlap. But whichever one is smaller, it's not very sensitive to. And you can see that if you make it more dramatic. Suppose this is the energy difference, that black thing there, and the blue thing across here is the overlap. You can see that the length of the orange diagonal isn't going to change very much if you double this. But if you double this, the orange thing will change a lot. Right? So, it's not so, so if the energy mismatch is great, it's not very sensitive to how much overlap you have. Okay? So now from this, having looked at that, we can generalize about what happens when you bring two orbitals together. Okay, so mixing two overlapping orbitals gives one composite orbital, LCAO, linear combination, the sum, that's lower in energy than either of the two parents were, right? And one that's higher in energy than either parent. And we can visualize that here at the start. And when they come together, you get this, right? One's higher than either, one's lower than either. The bonding and the antibonding, okay? The lower energy combination looks more like the lower energy parent. So if you had a mismatch at the beginning, they go up and down a little bit, but this one looks mostly like that, and the higher one looks mostly like the higher starting material. Okay? And if you have a certain amount of overlap, increasing energy mismatch increases the splitting, so that'll get bigger as you mismatch the energies, but it decreases the amount of mixing, right? Now the lower one looks mostly like the lower one. The higher one looks mostly like the higher one. They aren't mixed as much, right? And the magnitude of the energy shift, how much the energy went down from where it started or up from where it started in the antibonding orbital is not as big as when the energy was well matched, okay? So you increase the splitting but decrease the shifts when the energies don't start the same. This seems a little like a lot of words now. You need to rehearse this in the privacy of your room and it'll make sense, I think. Okay? Or even better than the privacy of your room is in some public place where you get together with other classmates and talk about it. Okay, so here are the two situations when they're apart and together. Energy match between A and B, energy mismatch between A and C. So the AC electrons clearly end up the bonding electrons, lower in energy. But that might not be the same as which bond is stronger. So let's think about which bond is stronger, A, B, or A, C. It's true that the electrons are lower in A, C than in A, B. But compared to what? That turns out, as you won't be surprised, to be the key question here. Okay? So, suppose you pull AC apart. These two electrons, if you pull AC apart, will go over here. These two electrons in AB could go over there. Okay? Now, if you do that, it takes more energy to break the AB bond than to break the AC bond. And the product, notice, is the electrons on B and C and not on A. So you're breaking the bond unsymmetrically. The electrons both go to one, C or B in this case. I mean, it could have been A, but it's cleaner if I write it as B. But it broke the bond unsymmetrically. Both electrons went one way. So it typically, that gives A plus and B minus, or C minus. Right? And so that says that the energy mismatch, the fact that C is lower than B, weakened the bond, made it easier to break into ions. Okay? Because the red didn't go up. So mismatch, making C down here not matched with A, helps out with what's called heterolysis, not symmetrical. They both go one way, both the electrons go one way. Okay? On the other hand, suppose we put one electron each way, right? This is called homolysis, symmetrical breaking of the bond, right? Then AC, if you break AB, you have the same energy here. But if you break AC, this one, it's true, doesn't go up very far, but this one goes up ever so much further. And now it's harder to break AC than to break AB. So this is, in fact, a trick question, which bond is stronger. It depends on what you call the bond, how you're breaking the bond, whether you break it symmetrically or unsymmetrically. One way, it's if you're heterolysis, then AB is stronger. Mismatch hurts the bond. But this way, mismatch hinders homolysis. So if you have it mismatched, it's harder to break if you're breaking into atoms. Now, of course, you will have noticed that when I said both electrons go the same way, I have to think carefully about the energy there, because if both the electrons go the same way, they're repelling one another when they're on the same atom, which isn't so great. So when you break into ions, that's a problem, the electron-electron repulsion, and you have to take that into account. Often it's better to break it symmetrically so you reduce the electron-electron repulsion. But we'll talk about that some more later when we talk about free radicals and ionization. Okay, now, so we've done it. The point of view of theory here, right? But we have more to do with more complicated molecules and recognizing functional groups and so on. But this is a good time to pause and see whether there's any evidence that this is true, what I've been telling you. Okay? So, of course, we need to look at experimental evidence. So, now, here's HH, where the two atoms match their energies perfectly. And here's HF, where they obviously mismatch. The F is lower because it's got a bigger nuclear charge. Even when it's, we're talking 2s orbitals on fluorine, not 1s, still the energy is lower. Okay, and you'll see that this is big on F and small on H, whereas this was symmetrical. That's what we predicted, that when they're mismatched, the best one, the bonding orbital, will look more like the lower one. Now, how about if we went to the antibonding orbital? What will it look like in HF? First, what will it look like in HH if we go to the antibonding orbital? Amy?
You've got evenly spaced.
HH is evenly spaced, right? But when I say what does it look like, I don't mean what the energy will be. I mean, what does the shape of the orbital look like, the antibond? How does it differ? This is the bonding orbital. A plus B builds up electron density in the middle. What does the orbital look like, the molecular orbital, for the antibond? If you looked at the wave function, how would the wave function, if you just plotted it, look different? The A plus B looks like this. What? You're talking energies, though, right? I'm not talking energy. I'm talking the actual shape of the function. Okay? but I've bored in on you so hard that we're not getting any place. Okay, Daisuke, what do you say? What does the antibond look like? Yeah, squared it looks like that, but what does the function itself look like? How can, if I drew the two pictures, do you think you could pick them apart to know which is the bonding and which is the antibonding orbital? Who thinks they could tell them apart? There's a node in the antibonding orbital, right? One is A plus B, the other is A minus B. So there's the antibonding orbital. Here's the antibonding orbital of fluorine, of HF. Now, it's an S orbital on H, but it's mixing with a P orbital of fluorine. And there's a node here, right? It goes from blue to red. So just as here, there's a node between the two in the antibond. Now, this is called sigma. This is called sigma star, right? That one's big on H. Here, the electrons are in the bond, not the antibond. That one's empty. And that star means that it's an antibonding molecular orbital, that it has a node between the nuclei. Notice, incidentally, that this is an antibonding node. We call it ABN. Nobody else calls it that. So that's an antibonding node. And I call it that because there's another node here. That node is not antibonding, right? That's just a node that's part of the fluorine atomic orbital. Right? It's not antibonding. What makes this orbital antibonding is that node between the two nuclei. Right? Not the fact that you're using a P orbital. Okay, so we'll talk about that more later. It's important when we're analyzing molecular orbitals to distinguish between antibonding nodes and atomic orbital nodes. Bonding means something that holds things together. Now, why does that hold things together? Because if the atoms come together, it goes down in energy. So those electrons have lower energy if it's together, and obviously they have to put energy in to bring them apart. So that's bonding. But these, the electrons that would be in the top ones, right? When you bring the nuclei together, those energies go up, right? And the energy would go down of those electrons. So if there were electrons there, there are not electrons there in H2 and HF. Those orbitals are vacant. But if there were electrons in there, they would have lower energy if the atoms moved apart.
So it's just like you put more energy in the system.
No, it's not that. If you put some other constraint on, maybe, that would hold them together. But if you held them together, those particular electrons would be high in energy and would come down in energy, so it would help to break the bond. Okay? That's really an important concept, so make sure you get that one straight. Okay, now, if you do heterolysis to A plus B minus, so H plus H minus, or H plus F minus, that's how, in the gas phase, right? It costs 400 kilocalories a mole to do it for H2, but only 373 to do it for HF. It's easier for HF to break that bond, right? So the HF bond is weaker. And that's what we said on the previous slide, that the energies are mismatched, heterolysis becomes easier, okay? And that's why you call it hydrofluoric acid, because it can easily break off H plus F minus, right? You don't call H2 hydrogenic acid, right? Because it doesn't do that easily. If you do homolysis and get H dot, or H dot F dot, right, then it's much easier for H2 than it is for HF. The HF bond is stronger if you're breaking it into two atoms, right? It's weaker if you're breaking it into ions, but stronger if you're breaking it into atoms. And it just depends on compared to what. What are you breaking it into? Okay, and notice, incidentally, that it's four times as hard to put the two, in the case of H2, and almost three times as hard in the case of HF to make both the electrons go the same way. That's what I was saying before. There's electron repulsion that you get in that case that you don't get in the other case. So generally, homolysis is easier in the gas phase than heterolysis for that reason. Okay, so now time for to extend this reality check by looking at the structure and dynamics of XH3 molecules. So this lecture and the next lecture will be about that, the rest of this lecture. Okay, so BH3, CH3, NH3. Very comparable. The only difference is how many valence electrons there are and how many protons in the central atom nucleus. Right? The number of valence electrons is 3 on boron, 4 on carbon, and 5 on nitrogen. So carbon has an odd electron, and nitrogen has an unshared pair of electrons. Right? Now, it turns out that one handy rule that we can use in seeing whether hybridization makes any difference and so on is to look at the geometry of the molecule. What's its shape? Right? So remember we saw that if the nucleus was here, an sp orbital, 2s, 2p, 50-50 of each would look like that schematically. Okay? Now, and if you're going to use another orbital on the same atom, those two orbitals must not overlap each other. Why not? Suppose you wanted to use an s orbital on the atom and also an sp orbital on the same atom with just a little bit of p and almost all s. So it's a different orbital. Can you put two electrons in each of those, one of which is 100% s, and the other, which is 95% S and 5% P? No, you can't do that. Because obviously, if you could do that, you could also do 99.99% S and 0.01% P. Those are obviously the same, right? So at what stage do they become sufficiently different that you can have two electrons in each of them, according to this thing called the Pauli principle, right? So the requirement that you can have two orbitals on the same atom and both of them have electrons in them is that there be no overlap. So they must not overlap each other, because to the extent that they overlap, they're the same and you aren't allowed to have two in each of them. But if they don't have any overlap, then you can do it. So we need, when we choose another orbital to use on this same nucleus, it must not overlap this one, right? And it's really pretty easy to figure out a relationship between the angles of the orbitals and their hybridization and their overlap. I'll show you how that works, although I'm not intending to prove it. I'm just stating it. But it's not hard to prove. In fact, it would be a neat problem, for those of you who really care about this, it's a neat problem to figure out. If you know the overlap between S and S on an atom, the overlap between P and P on the atom, the overlap between S and P, then you can figure out if you have a certain fraction of each of them and sum up the net overlap, how big is it? That's how you do this, but I'm just giving you the answer. Okay, suppose you have an sp that you're using and also an sp3 hybrid on the same carbon. What angle do you choose such that there's no net overlap between those two and you can use them independently? Okay, what's that angle? That's what we're going to talk about here. This is what you get if you work out this problem. I'm not going to assign it because I don't want you all spending your time doing that, but it's a fun problem. But you can develop this formula that the angle between spm and SPN, whatever these exponents are. Remember what those exponents mean? Right? It's the ratio of how much P to how much S squared. Okay? So SPM and SPN, the angle between those two is the angle whose cosine is minus 1 over the square root of M times N. Now let's just not worry about where that came from, although I told you how you can figure it out, right? But just look for several values of M and N and what the angle would be. So suppose it was at two sp orbitals, that is sp1. So this is 1 and that's 1. What's the angle? The denominator is 1. It's the angle whose cosine is minus 1. 180 degrees. Right? And you already knew that, right? That two sp orbitals make a line. How many of you knew that already? That's what I thought. And this is why. So they will be orthogonal, so they have no overlap. Okay, now suppose it's sp2. Then the denominator is going to be 2. So it's the angle whose cosine is minus a half. Anybody know what that is? (laughs) 120 degrees. So that's trigonal, right? The Mercedes symbol, right? And you knew that. I bet a lot of you knew that, that sp squared is trigonal, right? And sp3, that's the angle whose cosine is minus 1/3, right? Which turns out to be the angle in a central angle in a tetrahedron, 109 and a half degrees. Okay? Now suppose it's sp whatever, anything other than zero. SP0 would be pure S, right? But suppose it's SP something, but N is infinity. What's SP infinity? What's a more familiar name for an SP infinity? What's the N? It's the ratio of P to S. So what's SP infinity? It's pure P. So this is what's the angle between any old SP hybrid and a P orbital. Right, it's got to be 90. And that's the angle between pi P orbitals and sigma orbitals of any hybridization. Right? So by the angles you can tell what the hybridization is. Okay, suppose you have SP1 with SP3, which is the case we showed here. Then it's the cosine of the angle whose cosine is minus 1 over the square root of 3, which turns out to be 125.3 degrees, which is what that is. So you can tell any angle by the hybridization. Okay. Now, suppose you want to optimize the hybridization in XH3. You want to get the best possible hybridization. So what's the choice here? So you have your X atom in the middle. And you're going to be making 3 bonds in XH3. So you have 3 bonding atomic orbitals, and you're going to be contributing 1 electron to each of those, and the hydrogen's going to contribute the other one, and that's going to make the bond. Okay? And whatever the X atom, if it has any electrons left over, they'll be in whatever other orbital you're using that was left over after you made the 3 bonding ones. So the 3 XH bonds speak up and they say, use SP squared hybridization. Make 3 SP squared hybrids because that gives the best overlap for 3 hybrids. We talked about that before last time in the context of carbon. That S3, you can make 3 SP2 hybrids, right? And they'll give better overlap than any other set of 3 you can give. Okay, so that's the point of view of the bonds, but that's not all there is to it. The X atom itself speaks up and said, okay, make your 3 bonds. But make sure you don't waste any of my S orbital. The S orbital is lower in energy than the P orbital. Don't let there be a vacant S orbital. Make sure that there are 2 electrons in S orbitals. Or hybrids that involve the S orbital. Okay? Now, boron has 3 valence electrons, carbon 4 and nitrogen 5. So the atom says, aha, fine, use 3 SP squared hybrids. Each of them uses a third of the S. We've used up all the S for these 3 bonds. That's great. We'll leave a P orbital vacant, no electron to go in there. Hunky-dory, right? We've optimized the use of S. This is from the atom's point of view. And the nitrogen says, whoa, wait a second. I don't want to leave an S orbital vacant. I mean, I don't want to leave there are going to be 3 electrons in bonds, and then there's going to be a pair of electrons. But I want to put that pair in the S orbital, in the low energy orbital, and then put only 1 electron in each of the others. So I'm making the best use out of the S orbital, put 2 electrons rather than 1 there. Okay, so that's quite different from what boron thinks. What does carbon think? Whatever. Right? Because it's going to use 4 orbitals and put 1 electron in each of them. And over all that set, it's going to have S and P. They're going to use up all the S's and P's. And it doesn't care how it hybridizes. You're going to, as far as the atom concerns, it's going to be the same. Right? If you have a valence state where there's one electron in each. Okay. But this can make create a conflict if the bonds are saying use SP squared. Right? So I'm going to stop here now. And next time we're going to continue with this fight between the bonds and the atoms to decide what hybridization to use.